Chapter 17. Aboard the steamer Fever Dream, New Orleans, August 1857. It seemed as though half the steamers in New Orleans had decided to leave that afternoon, Abner Marsh thought as he stood upon the hurricane deck and watched them all depart. The custom was for boats going upriver to make their departure from the levee about 5 o'clock. At 3, the engineers would fire the furnaces and start to get the steam up. Rosin and pitch pine would get chucked into the steamer's hungry maws, along with wood and coal, and from one boat after another the black smoke would start to rise, ascending from the lofty flowered chimneys in tall, hot columns, dark pennants of farewell. 4 miles of steamboats packed solid along the levee can generate a lot of smoke. The sooty columns would start to blend together into one massive black cloud a couple of 100 feet above the river, a cloud shot through with ash, full of hot, bright cinders, adrift on the wind. Larger and larger, the cloud would swell as still more steamers fired up and poured out smoke, until the pall blotted out the sun and began to creep across the face of the city. From Abner Marsh's vantage point on the hurricane deck, it looked as though the whole city of New Orleans was going up in flames, and all the steamers were about to flee. It made him feel uneasy, as if somehow the other captains knew something he did not, as if the Fever Dream, too, ought to be getting up her steam and making ready to back out. Marsh was anxious to be off. For all the wealth and glamour of the New Orleans trade, he yearned for the rivers he knew, for the upper Mississippi with its bluffs and dense woods, for the wild, muddy Missouri that ate steamers like nobody's business, for the narrow Illinois and the silty, bustling Fever. The Fever Dream's maiden voyage down the Ohio seemed almost idyllic to him now, a remembrance of simpler, better days. Not even 2 months gone, it seemed an eternity ago. Ever since they left St. Louis and come downriver, things had been going wrong, and the further south they'd come, the worse they'd gotten.
Joshua's right, Marsh muttered to himself as he looked out over New Orleans. There's something rotten here.
It was too damn hot, too damn wet, with too damn many bugs, enough to make a man think there was a curse on the whole damn place. And maybe there was, on account of the slavery, though Marsh wasn't sure about that. All he was sure of was that he wanted to tell Whitey to fire up the boilers and roust Fram or Albright up to the pilot house so he could back the Fever Dream clear of the landing and get her upriver, now, before sunset, before they arrive. Abner Marsh wanted to shout those orders so bad he could taste the words lying bitter and unspoken on his tongue. He felt a kind of superstitious dread about this evening, though he told himself over and over that he was not a superstitious man. Still, he wasn't blind either. The sky was hot and suffocating, and west of them a storm was building, a big one, a ripper, the storm that Dan Albright had smelled a couple of days back. And the steamers were leaving, one after another, dozens of them. And as Marsh watched them recede upriver and vanish in the shimmering waves of heat, he felt more and more alone, as if each steamboat that faded into the distance carried a small bit of him aboard her, a piece of courage, a hunk of his certainty, a dream or a small, sooty hope. Lots of steamers left New Orleans every day, Marsh thought to himself, and today is no different. It's just a day like any other day on the river in August. Hot and smoky and lazy, everyone moving slow, waiting, maybe for a breath of cool air or for the clean, fresh rain that would wash the smoke from the sky. But another part of him, an older and deeper part, knew that what they waited for was neither cool nor clean, and it would bring no relief from the heat, the dampness, the bugs, the fear. Down below, Hairy Mike was roaring at his roustabouts and making threatening gestures with his black iron billet. But the noises from the landing and the bells and whistles of the other steamers drowned out his words. A mountain of cargo waited on the levee, almost 1,000 tons, the Fever Dream's top capacity. Hardly a quarter of it had been carried across the narrow planks to the main deck. It would take hours to get the rest aboard. Even if he wanted to, Marsh could not take them out, not with all that freight awaiting on the landing. Hairy Mike and Jeffers and the rest would think he'd gone mad. He wished he'd been able to tell them, like he'd intended to make plans with them. But there wasn't time. Everything had begun to move so quickly, and tonight after dark this Damon Julian would come aboard the Fever Dream to dine. There was no time to talk to Hairy Mike or Jonathan Jeffers, no time to explain or persuade or deal with the doubts and questions they'd surely have. So tonight Abner Marsh would be alone, or almost alone. Just him and Joshua in a room full of them, the night folks. Marsh did not count Joshua York with the others. He was different somehow. And Joshua said that everything would go well. Joshua had his drink. Joshua was full of fine-sounding words and dreams. But Abner Marsh had his misgivings. The fever dream was quiet, almost deserted. Joshua had sent almost everyone ashore. The dinner tonight would be as private as he could make it. That wasn't the way Abner Marsh would have liked it, but there was no arguing with Joshua when he got a notion in his head. In the main cabin, the table was already set. The lamps had not been lighted yet, and the smoke and steam and building storm outside had all conspired to make the illumination that poured through the skylights dim and sombre and tired. It seemed to Marsh as if twilight had already come to the saloon and to his steamer. The carpets looked almost black. The mirrors were full of shadows. Behind the long black marble bar, a man was cleaning glasses, but even he was indistinct somehow, faded. Marsh nodded to him nonetheless, and made his way to the kitchen, aft of the wheelhouse. Behind the kitchen doors he found activity. A couple of Toby's kitchen boys were stirring big copper pots or pan-frying chicken, while the waiters lounged around and joked with each other. Marsh could smell pies baking in the huge ovens. It made his mouth water, but he pushed past, resolute. He found Toby in the starboard galley, surrounded on all sides by stacks of cages full of chickens and pigeons, and here and there some robins and ducks and such. The birds were making a terrible racket. Toby looked up when Marsh entered. The cook had been killing chickens. Three headless birds were piled up by his elbows, and a fourth was on the block in front of him, struggling fitfully. Toby had the cleaver in hand.
"Why, Cabin Marsh," he said, smiling.
He brought the cleaver down smartly with a solid thunk. Blood spurted, and the headless chicken thrashed crazily when Toby released it. His hard black hands were drenched with blood. He wiped them on his apron.
"What can I do for you?" he asked. "I just wanted to tell you tonight when dinner's done, I want you off the boat," Marsh said. "You serve us up good and proper, and then you get. Take your kitchen boys and them waiters with you. You understand, do you? You hear what I'm saying?" "I surely do, Captain," Toby said with a grin. "I surely do. Going to have a little party, is you?" "Never you mind about that," Marsh said. "Just see that you get ashore when you're done working."
He turned to go, stern-faced, but something made him turn back.
"Toby,"
he said.
"Yes, sir." "You know I never held much with slavery, even if I never done much against it, neither. I would have, but those damned abolitionists were such Bible thumpers. Only I've been thinking, and it seems to me maybe they was right after all. You can't just go using another kind of people like they wasn't people at all. Know what I mean? Got to end sooner or later. Better if it ends peaceful, but it's got to end even if it has to be with fire and blood, you see? Maybe that's what them abolitionists been saying all along. You try to be reasonable, that's only right, but if it don't work, you got to be ready. Some things is just wrong. They gotta be ended."
Toby was looking at him queerly, still absent-mindedly wiping his hands across the front of his apron, back and forth, back and forth.
"Cap'n," he said softly, "you was talking of abolition. This here is slave country, Cap'n. You could get killed for such talk." "Maybe I could, Toby, but right is right, that's what I say. You done good by old Toby, Cap'n Marsh. Given me my freedom and all so's I could cook for you. That you did."
Abner Marsh nodded.
"Toby," he said, "why don't you go fetch me a knife from the kitchen? Don't say nothing about it, you hear? Just go fetch me a good sharp knife. I'll be able to slide down into my boot, I think. Can you get me a knife?" "Yes, sir, Captain Marsh," said Toby.
His eyes narrowed just a little in his worn black face.
"Yes, sir."
Then he ran to obey. Abner Marsh walked a little strangely for the next couple of hours, with the long kitchen knife snugly tucked into his high leather boot. By the time dark had fallen, however, the blade had begun to feel damned comfortable, and he almost forgot that it was there. The storm came just before sunset. Most of the steamers headed upriver were long gone by then, although others had come to take their places along the New Orleans levee. The storm broke with a terrible roaring sound like a steamer's boilers going up, and the lightning flashed overhead, and the rain came a-screaming down, torrential as a spring flood. Marsh stood beneath the cover of the boiler deck promenade, listening to the water pound against his steamer and watching folks on the landing scramble for cover. He had been standing there for the longest time, leaning on the rail and thinking, when suddenly Joshua York was there beside him.
"It's raining, Joshua," Marsh said, pointing his stick out into the storm. "Maybe this Julian won't be coming tonight. Maybe he don't want to get wet."
Joshua York wore a strange, solemn look. "He will come," he said. That was all. Just, "He will come." And, finally, he did. The storm had subsided by then. The rain still came down and down, but it was gentler, softer, hardly more than a mist. Abner Marsh was still on the boiler deck, and he saw them coming, striding across the deserted, rain-slick levee. Even at a distance he knew it was them. There was something about the way they walked, something graceful and predatory, full of a terrible beauty. One of them walked different, swaggering and sliding like he was trying to be one of them but couldn't, and when they came closer, Marsh saw that it was Sour Billy Tipton. He was carrying something awkwardly. Abner Marsh went on into the Grand Saloon. The others were all at table. Simon and Catherine, Smith and Brown, Raymond and Jean and Valerie, and all the others that Joshua had gathered along the river. They were talking softly, but they fell silent when Marsh entered.
"They're coming," Marsh said.
Joshua York rose from his seat at the head of the table and went to meet them. Abner Marsh went to the bar and poured himself a whiskey. He drained it in a gulp, had another quickly, then went to the table. Joshua had insisted Marsh sit right up by the head, on his left-hand side. The chair to his right was saved for this Damon Julian. Marsh plopped down heavily and scowled at the empty place across from him. And then they entered. Only the four night folks came into the saloon, Marsh noted. Sour Billy had been left behind somewhere, which suited him just fine. There were two women, and a huge white-faced man who frowned darkly and shook the moisture from his coat. And the other, him. Marsh knew him instantly. He had a smooth, ageless face framed by black curls, and he looked like some kind of lord in his dark burgundy suit, with a loose-collared silk shirt all ruffled down the front. On one finger he wore a gold ring, with a sapphire the size of a sugar cube, and fastened to his black vest was a headlight, a polished chunk of black diamond and a soft web of yellow gold. He moved across the room and then, rounding the table, he paused and stood by Joshua's place behind the chair at the head of the table. He put his smooth white hands upon the chair back, and he looked at them, one by one, all along the table. And they rose. The three who had come with him first, and then Raymond Ortega, and then Cara, and then the rest in ones and twos, Valerie last of all. Everyone in the room was standing, everyone but Abner Marsh. Damon Julian smiled a charming, warm smile.
"It is good to be together with all of you once again," he said.
He looked especially at Catherine.
"My dear, how many years has it been? How very many years."
The grin that lit her vulture face was terrible to behold, Marsh thought. He decided to take matters into his own hands.
"Sit down," he barked up at Damon Julian. He tugged him by the sleeve. "I'm hungry, and we've waited supper just about long enough."
"Yes," said Joshua, and that broke the spell, and everyone took seats again. But Julian took Joshua's seat, the seat at the head of the table. Joshua came and stood over Julian. "You're in my seat," he said. His voice seemed flat and tense.
"This one is yours, sir, if you will be so kind."
York gestured. His eyes were fixed on Damon Julian, and Marsh glanced up at Joshua's face and saw the power there, the cold intensity, the determination. Damon Julian smiled.
"Ah," he said softly. He shrugged slightly. "Pardon."
Then, never looking up at Joshua York for even an instant, he rose and moved to the other seat. Joshua seated himself stiffly and made an impatient motion with his fingers. A waiter came hurrying from the shadows and deposited a bottle on the table in front of York. "Kindly leave the room," Joshua told the youth. The bottle was unlabeled. Beneath the chandeliers, surrounded by gleaming crystal and silver, it seemed dark and threatening. It had been opened.
"You know what this is," Joshua York said flatly to Damon Julian. Yes. York reached out, took up Julian's wine glass and poured. He filled the glass to the brim and put it down again squarely in front of the other. Drink, he ordered. York's eyes were on Julian. Julian stared at the glass, a faint smile playing around the corners of his mouth as if he were involved in some secret amusement. The grand saloon was utterly silent. Far off in the distance, Marsh heard the faint wail of a steamer struggling through the rain. The moment seemed to last forever. Damon Julian reached out, took up the glass, and drank. In a single long draught, he emptied the glass, and it was as if he drank all the tension from the room. Joshua smiled, Abner Marsh grunted, and down at the far end of the table, others traded wary, puzzled glances. York poured three more glasses and had them passed down to Julian's three companions. All of them drank. Conversations began in low whispers. Damon Julian smiled at Abner Marsh.
Your steamer is most impressive, Captain Marsh, he said cordially. I hope the food is as excellent.
The food, said Marsh, is better, he bellowed, feeling almost like his own self again,
and the waiters began bringing out the feast that Toby had cooked up. For more than an hour they ate. The Mite folks had fine manners, but their appetites were healthy as any riverman's. They went at the food like a bunch of roustabouts who'd just heard the mate shout, "Grub pile!" All except Damon Julian, that was. Julian ate slowly, almost delicately, pausing often to sip at his wine, smiling frequently for no apparent reason. Marsh had cleaned off his third platter, and Julian's plate was still half full. Conversation was relaxed and inconsequential. Those far away talked low and heatedly, so Marsh couldn't make out what they were saying. Up close, Joshua York and Damon Julian mouthed a lot of words about the storm, the heat, the river, and the fever dream. Except for when they were talking about his steamer, Abner Marsh took little interest, preferring to concentrate on his plate. Finally, coffee and brandy were served, and then the waiters faded away and the main cabin of the steamer was empty but for Abner Marsh and the night folks. Marsh sipped at his brandy and heard the noise he made sucking it up before he quite realized that all conversations had ceased. "We are together at last," Joshua said in a quiet voice. "And this is a new beginning for us, for the people of the night. Those who live by day might call it a new dawning," he smiled. "For us, a new sunset might be a more appropriate metaphor. Listen, all of you. Let me tell you of my plans." Then Joshua rose and began to speak in earnest. How long he spoke, Abner Marsh was not sure. Marsh had heard it all before: freedom from the red thirst, an end of fear, trust between day and night, the things that would be achieved by partnership, the grand new epoch. On and on Joshua went, eloquent, impassioned, his speech full of little snatches of poems and $5 words. Marsh paid more attention to the others, to the rows of pale faces all up and down the table. All of them had their eyes on Joshua. All of them were listening silent. But they weren't all the same. Simon seemed a little jumpy and kept glancing from York to Julian and back again. Jean Ardon looked rapt and worshipful, but some of the other faces were blank and cold and hard to read. Raymond Ortega was smiling slyly, and the big one called Kurt was frowning, and Valerie looked nervous, and Catherine. She had on her thin, hard face such a look of utter loathing that Marsh flinched to see it. Then Marsh looked directly across the table to where Damon Julian was seated, and found Julian staring back at him. His eyes were black, hard and shiny as a lump of the best coal. Marsh saw pits there, endless, bottomless pits, a chasm waiting to swallow them all up. He wrenched his eyes away, unwilling to even try to stare down Julian as he had foolishly tried to stare down York so long ago at the planter's house. Julian smiled, glanced up again at Joshua, sipped at his cold coffee, and listened. Abner Marsh did not like that smile, nor the depth of those eyes. All at once he was afraid again. And finally Joshua finished and sat down.
"The steamboat is a fine idea," Julian said pleasantly. His soft voice carried the length of the saloon. "Your drink may even have its uses from time to time. The rest, dear Joshua, you must forget."
His tone was charming, his smile relaxed and brilliant.
Someone drew in his breath sharply, but no one dared to speak. Abner Marsh sat up very straight. Joshua frowned.
"Excuse me," he said.
Julian made a languid gesture of dismissal.
"Your story makes me sad, dear Joshua," he said. "Raised among the cattle, now you think as they do. It is not your fault, of course. In time you will learn, you will celebrate your true nature. They have corrupted you, these little animals you have lived among. They have filled you with their small moralities, their feeble religions, their tedious dreams."
"What are you saying?" Joshua's voice was angry. Julian did not answer him directly. Instead, he turned to Marsh.
"Captain Marsh," he asked, "that roast you so enjoyed was once part of a living animal. Do you suppose that if that beast could talk, he would consent to being eaten?"
His eyes, those fierce black eyes, were locked on Marsh, demanding an answer.
"Aye? Hell no, but..." "But you eat him anyway, do you not?"
Julian laughed lightly.
"Of course you do, Captain. Don't be ashamed of it." "I ain't ashamed," Marsh said stoutly. "It's only a cow." "Of course it is," said Julian. "And cattle are cattle."
He looked back at Joshua York.
"But the cattle may see it differently. However, that ought not to trouble the captain here. He is a higher order of being than his cow. It is his nature to kill and eat, and the cows to be killed and eaten. You see, Joshua, life is really very simple. Your errors rise from being raised among cows who have taught you not to consume them. Evil, you talk about. Where did you learn that concept? From them, of course, from the cattle. Good and evil, those are cattle words, empty, intended only to preserve their worthless lives. They live and die in mortal dread of us, their natural superiors. We haunt even their dreams, so they seek solace in lies and invent gods who have power over us, wanting to believe that somehow crosses and holy water can master us. You must understand, dear Joshua, that there is no good or evil, only strength and weakness, masters and slaves. You are feverish with their morality, with guilt and shame. How foolish that is. These are their words, not ours. You preach of new beginnings, but what shall we begin? To be as cattle? To burn beneath their sun, work when we might take, bow to cattle gods? No. They are animals, our natural inferiors, our great and beautiful prey. That is the way of things.
No, said Joshua York.
He pushed back his chair and rose, so he stood over the table like a pale, slender Goliath.
They think, they dream, and they have built a world, Julian. You are wrong. We are cousins, both sides of the same coin. They are not prey. Look at all they have done. They bring beauty into the world. What have we created? Nothing. The red thirst has been our bane.
Damon Julian sighed.
Ah, poor Joshua, he said.
He sipped his brandy.
Let the cattle create. Life, beauty, what you will. And we shall take their creations, use them, destroy them if we choose. That is the way of it. We are the masters. Masters do not labor. Let them make the suits. We shall wear them. Let them build the steamboats, we shall ride upon them. Let them dream of life eternal, we shall live it and drink of their lives and savor the blood. We are the lords of this earth, and that is our heritage, our destiny, if you will, dear Joshua. Exult in your nature, Joshua. Do not seek to change it. Those cattle who truly know us envy us. Any of them would be as we are given the choice.
Julian smiled maliciously.
Have you ever wondered why this Jesus Christ of theirs bid his followers to drink his blood if they would live forever?
He chuckled.
They burn to be like us, just as the darkies dream of being white. You see how far they go. To play at being masters, they even enslave their own kind.
As you do, Julian, said Joshua York dangerously. What else do you call the dominion you've held over our own people?
Even those you call masters you make slaves to your own twisted will?
Even we have strong and weak amongst us, dear Joshua, said Damon Julian. It is fitting that the strong should lead.
Julian set down his glass and looked far down the table.
Kurt, he said, summon Billy.
Yes, Damon, said the big man, rising. Where are you going? Joshua demanded, as Kurt strode from the room, his image moving purposefully across a dozen mirrors.
You have played at being cattle long enough, Joshua, said Julian. I'm going to teach you what it means to be a master.
Abner Marsh felt cold and frightened. All the eyes in the room were glassy, transfixed, watching the drama at the head of the table. Standing, Joshua York seemed to tower over the seated Damon Julian, but somehow he did not dominate. Joshua's grey eyes looked as strong and as passionate as a man's could be. But Julian wasn't a man at all, Marsh thought. Kurt was back in less than a moment. Sour Billy must have been just outside somewhere, like a slave waiting for his master's summons. Kurt took his place again. Sour Billy Tipton sauntered right up to the head of the table, carrying something, with a strange sort of excitement in his icy eyes. Damon Julian swept the plates aside with an arm, clearing a space on the table. Sour Billy shifted his burden and set a small brown infant down on the tablecloth in front of Joshua York.
What the hell?
Marsh roared. He pushed back from the table, glaring, and started to rise.
Sit down and keep real quiet, boy, Sour Billy said in a flat, quiet voice.
Marsh started to turn toward him and felt something cold and very sharp pressed gently against the side of his neck.
You open your mouth, I'm going to have to bleed you, Sour Billy said. Can you just imagine what they'll do when they see all that nice hot blood?
Trembling, caught between rage and terror, Abner Marsh sat very still. The point of Billy's knife pressed a little harder, and Marsh felt something warm and wet trickle down into his collar.
Good, whispered Billy. Real nice.
Joshua York glanced briefly at Marsh and Sour Billy, then turned his attention back to Julian.
I find this obscene, he said coldly. Julian, I do not know why you had this child brought here, but I do not like it. This game will end right now. Tell your man to take his knife away from the captain's throat.
Ah, said Julian, and if I do not choose to? You will choose to, said Joshua. I am Bloodmaster.
Are you? Asked Julian lightly. Yes, I do not like to use your methods of compulsion, Julian, but if I must, I shall.
Ah, said Julian.
He smiled. He stood up, stretched lazily like some great dark cat waking from a nap, then extended a hand across the table towards Sour Billy.
Billy, give your knife to me, he said.
But what about him?
Sour Billy said.
Cabin Marsh will behave himself now, said Julian. The knife.
Billy handed it over, hilt first.
Good, said Joshua.
He got no further. The baby, undersized, scrawny, very brown and very naked, made a sort of gurgling noise just then and stirred feebly. And Damon Julian did the most horrible thing that Abner Marsh had ever seen in all his born days. Swiftly and very delicately, he leaned over the table and brought down Sour Billy's knife and cut the infant's small right hand clean off with a single smooth stroke. The baby began to howl. Blood spurted onto the table, over the crystal glasses and the silverware and the fine white linen. The baby's limbs thrashed feebly and the blood began to pool. And Julian impaled the severed hand. It was so impossibly tiny, hardly the size of Marsh's big toe, on the blade of Billy's knife. He held it up dripping in front of Joshua York.
Drink, he said, and all the lightness was gone from his voice.
York slapped the knife aside. It spun from Julian's hand, the hand still impaled upon it, and landed 6 feet away on the carpet. Joshua looked like death. He reached down, put two strong fingers on either side of the infant's thrashing wrist, and pressed. The bleeding stopped.
Get me a cord, he commanded.
No one moved. The infant was still screaming.
There is an easier way to quiet him, Julian said.
He took his own hard, pale hand and clamped it down across the child's mouth. The hand enveloped the small brown head completely and stifled all sound. Julian began to squeeze.
"Release him!" shouted York.
"Look at me," said Julian. "Look at me, Blood Master."
And their eyes met as they stood there above the table, each with a hand on the small brown piece of humanity before them. Abner Marsh just sat there, thunderstruck, sick and furious and wanting to do something, but somehow unable to move. Like all the rest of them, he stared at York and Julian, at the strange, silent battle of wills. Joshua York was trembling. His mouth was tight with anger, and cords stood up on his neck, and his grey eyes were as cold and forceful as an ice jam. He stood there like a man possessed, a pale, wrathful god in white and blue and silver. It was impossible for anything to withstand that outpouring of will, of strength, Marsh thought. Impossible. And then he looked at Damon Julian. The eyes dominated the face. Cold, black, malevolent, implacable. Abner Marsh looked into those eyes a moment too long, and suddenly he felt dizzy. He heard men screaming somewhere, distantly, and his mouth was warm with the taste of blood. He saw all the masks that were called Damon Julian, and Gilles Lamont, and Gilbert Dacan, and Philip Kane, and Sergei Alexov, and 1,000 other men fall away, and behind each one was another, older and more horrible, layer on layer of them, each more bestial than the last, and at the bottom the thing had no charm, no smile, no fine words, no rich clothing or jewels, the thing had nothing of humanity, was nothing of humanity, had only the thirst, the fever, red, red, ancient and insatiable. It was primal and inhuman, and it was strong. It lived and breathed and drank the stuff of fear, and it was old, oh, so old, older than man and all his works, older than the forests and rivers, older than dreams. Abner Marsh blinked, and there across the table from him was an animal, a tall, handsome animal in burgundy, and there was nothing the least bit human about it, and the lines of its face were the lines of terror, and its eyes were red, not black at all, red and lit from within, and red, burning, thirsting red. Joshua York released the infant's stump. A sudden pent-up wash of blood spurted feebly out across the table. An instant later, a sound like a terrible wet crunch filled the saloon. And Abner Marsh, still half-dazed, slid the long kitchen knife out of his boot and came out of his seat screaming, raving, slashing. Sour Billy tried to grab him from behind, but Marsh was too strong, too wild. He brushed Billy aside and flung himself across the dinner table at Damon Julian. Julian broke away from Joshua York's eyes just in time and pulled back slightly. The knife missed his eye by a fraction of an inch and left a long, open gash down the right side of his face. Blood welled out of the wound, and Julian made a snarling sound deep in his throat. Then someone seized Marsh from behind and dragged him off the table and flung him backward across the grand saloon, lifted him and flung him, all 300 pounds of him, like he was a small child. It hurt something fierce when he landed, but somehow Marsh managed to roll over and get back to his feet. It was Joshua had thrown him, he saw, and Joshua who was standing closest to him now, Joshua with pale hands trembling and grey eyes full of fear. "Run, Abner," he said. "Get off the steamer. Run." Behind him, the others had all risen from the table. White faces, eyes intent and staring, hands pale and hard and grasping. Catherine was smiling. Smiling at him the way she'd smiled when she'd caught him coming from Joshua's cabin. Old Simon was shaking. Even Smith and Brown were drifting toward him, slowly ringing him in, and their eyes were not friendly, and their lips were wet. They were all moving, all of them, and Damon Julian came gliding around the table, almost soundless, the blood drying on his cheek, the gash closing almost as Marsh watched. Abner Marsh looked down at his hands and discovered that he had lost the knife. He backed up step by step until his back was up against a mirrored stateroom door. "Run, Abner!" Joshua York repeated. Marsh fumbled and opened the door and backed into the cabin behind him. and he saw Joshua turn his back and stand between the cabin and the others, Julian and Catherine and all the rest, the night folks, the vampires. And that was the last thing he saw before he broke and ran.